And he will talk about pure spinor type 2A superstrings in general backgrounds.
Well, I am very happy to be here to celebrate the birthday of Ricardo, old and Greek friend. And my talk deal with the pre-spinor approach to type 2 superstrings. In particular, superstrings in general background. In particular, I will describe a method called the method of extended field differential algebra that allow to derive the pre-spinor constraint and the pre-spinor action. Okay. Well, I think that this subject is quite suited for this fest. Science is background is just the geometrical description of supergravity, a field where Ricardo has obtained many important result, and also is fitted because the word that I will describe is literally based on a recent paper by Lauria with Grassi, Frey and Trigiante. Well, the Berkovic pre-spinor approach.
Scusa, ti metto questo che è un microfono un po' più alto.
Non si sente niente?
Perché si sente poco, purtroppo.
Scusa,
c'è anche...
io posso un po'...
Ecco qua, allora adesso... Ecco qua, guarda, così dovrebbe andare bene. Prova a parlare.
Va bene, ok. So, the Berkovic pre-spinor approach of superstring, well... The main ingredient of this approach are the presence of ghost, commuting ghost lambda, which satisfies the pre-spinor constraint, lambda gamma lambda equals zero, and an nilpotent BLS charge Q, which is linear in lambda. The action must be invariant under the action of Q, so that Q is both nilpotent and conserved. The approach provides a covariant quantization of superstrings in flat superspace or in special background as entity sitter 5 times sitter 5, and therefore it provides a solution of all the problem of the covariant quantization of Green-Schwarz strings. The Green-Schwarz approach, as you know, is the synoptic with the pre-spinor one. If you like, the pre-spinor approach is son of the Green-Schwarz one. However, the pre-spinor approach is also important, useful to describe superstring in general back, to describe a sigma model action for superstring in general background, in particular in presence of Ramon-Ramon superfields. The general action in this case has been obtained some time ago by Berkovic and Rau, and their strategy was to write down the more general action, the more general conformal action for the superstrings, then require an hypothesis of Q and holomorphicity of the BLS current, or equivalently invariant of the action under the action of Q, and then derive the costello o sei costento super gravity. Recently, d'aria, gas frentigiante has reversed this pattern. They started from the supergravity constraint and curvature and parapetization of torsion curvature extended to include the BRS differential and the supersymmetric ghost, and then derived the Suzy transformation, the ghost constraint, and the superstrings action. However, in this way, the constraint that they obtain are not exactly the two-spinor constraint, and moreover, the action is quite complicated. In this talk, I present a variant of the approach of Daria et al., again based on the standard free differential algebra, that leads to the standard two-spinor constraints and to the action of Berkowitz and Rao. The plan of the talk is the following. First, I give a very short description of the geometrical description of a very short review of the geometrical description of 2A supergravity, just to fix my notation, and then I describe the method of extended free differential algebra and derive the Gauss constraint. Finally, I derive the pure spinor action. The geometrical description of type 2A supergravity is based to the following superform: Wellbein, that is vector-like Wellbein EA, and spinor-like Wellbein EL alpha, R alpha, which are a couple of left-handed and right-handed Wellbein spinor. Then there is the Lorentz connection, omega AB Lorentz valued, the NS and S potential, B2, which is a two superform, the Ramon-Ramon potential, C1 and C3, one form and three forms, one superform, three superform, and finally the Dilaton superfin phi. The curvature of this form are the torsion for the Wellbein, the Lorentz curvature LAB, and SNS curvature H3, and the Ramon-Ramon curvature G2 and G4, and this curvature satisfies the free differential algebra of the Bianchi identity, which we see there. At that point, one imposes suitable constraint on the component of torsion curvature of lowest dimension and solve the Bianchi identities under this constraint. And in this way, we get the field equation of supergravity, so that the supergravity is restricted to be a shell. There is some freedom in the choice of the constraint related to the possible redefinition of superfield and superform. And I will adopt the constraint used by Daria et al. That lead to the following parametrization of torsion curvature. Here, ML alpha beta is a bispinor given in terms of derivative of the covariant derivative of the dilaton and the free strength of G2 and G4. ML is the transpose of ML, and theta are combination of the gravitation of his strength. The reason why I have marked in blue the terms which are quadratic in the spinor-like Wellbein will be clear in a moment. The method suggested by Daria et al., the method that I call the method of extended free differential algebra, is a generalization of a procedure well known for Young-Mills theory. Let me review the case of Young-Mills to illustrate the method. When considering the young Miss algebra, which consists of Hamming connection A, which is valued the group, the algebra of the gauge group, the field strength F, the A plus A, and the Bianchi identity delta F equal zero. The extended Hamming algebra is obtained by replacing the differential D with the extended differential at D, which is D plus B, capital S, and extended A, replacing A with extended A given by A plus C, where S is the total BLS differential, and C is the ghost. Also notice that hat F, extended F, is equal to F. The added object have the same algebraic structure as the unhatted one, so that we can write hat F, which is equal to F, equal extended D, extended A, plus extended A, extended A. And if you develop this identity in ghost number, we have that in the sector. With ghost number and ghost equal zero, we recover one. In the sector with ghost number one, one has that SA equal DC minus C minus AC, which is just the BLS transformation of A. And in the sector with ghost number two, one has SC equal minus CC, which is just the BLS transformation of the ghost. The approach illustrated for Hamming's algebra can be generalized to the algebra of supergravity, in particular 2A supergravity. And Laurietal, indeed, used this method, assuming that all the ghosts associated with bosonic symmetry vanish and keeping non-vanishing only the ghost lambda L and lambda R associated with supersymmetry. My proposal differs from that of Laurietal in two respects. First, I keep non-vanishing not only the ghost lambda L and lambda R, but also the ghost sigma 0, I call sigma 0 or 1, sigma 2 and PAB related to the gauge transformation of the potential C1, B2, C3, and the Lorentz transformation. However, I maintain that the ghost lambda A related to translation vanish. The reason why I take lambda A equal zero, I maintain lambda A equal zero, is that lambda A equal zero is nothing else than the superembedding constraint. And you know, perhaps the superembedding approach is strongly related to the Green-Schwann one, and in particular give a geometric description of the kappa symmetry in Green-Schwann. Well, the second difference is the following. Since the charge Q generate the BLS transformation for the lambda, related to the ghost lambda, I split the total, the full BLS differential, capital S, as S plus delta, where S, little s, is the BLS differential related to the ghost lambda L, lambda R, and delta generate Lorentz transformation and gauge transformation of C1, B2, and C3 with the related ghost as parameter. Now we can define the extended object. The rule is to add to differential D the total BLS differential into the connection potential the related ghost. So we define extended D equal D plus S plus delta all the plus still presentative I explain in a moment what this means. Then extended AA, well AA, because I have assumed that the related ghost is zero. Extended I lambda equal I lambda plus lambda L. Extended right is I right plus lambda right. And but at that point for the superform, for the other superform, one has two possibility. The rule is to add to the potential the ghost. For instance, for the Lorentz potential omega, one must add the ghost psi. But who is omega? Omega is Ec times omega C A B. Well, this omega is big omega, is a big print. Now, or we extend also the Wilbane Ec writing E at C omega C B plus P A B, this is a first possibility, or simply we write omega B plus rather got P tilde B. The same for extended B2, extended C1, extended C3, we got to row 1, sigma 0, sigma 2. Of course, psi tilde psi since 8 gamma is I gamma plus lambda, there is a relation between psi tilde and psi like that, and so on. Now, we can be more precise about the definition of delta. There are two equivalent options. The first, delta is the following. Delta induced Lorentz negator formation with parameters psi, b, sigma 0, rho 1, sigma 2. In this case, delta is anti-commute in size. Capital S, the total Lorentz transformation, is nilpotent, and delta also. Also, S, generated by Q, is nilpotent. But in this case, S induces also Lorentz transformation with parameters lambda omega, lambda gamma omega gamma, acting on Lorentz vector or spinor. Second possibility, called at delta, tilde, delta tilde. Delta tilde induce Lorentz negator formation parameter psi tilde, sigma tilde, or tilde, sigma tilde. In writing S plus delta is S tilde plus delta tilde, now delta tilde and S tilde do not anti-commute, and S tilde is not important. For instance, acting on a vector, it gives not zero, but a Lorentz transformation with the Lorentz parameter given by the dumb contraction of the curvature. Now, tilde S induces covariant transformation, therefore it represents the covariant BLS differential. A further remark is needed. As a technical device, I will assume also that the covariant BLS differential of the ghost rho 1, rho tilde 1, related with NS and SF superform B2 is zero. But afterward, I will prove that this assumption is natural and almost automatically satisfied. Now we can write the extended parametrization of extended torsion in curvature, simply copying the parametrization that we have shown before. brillanti di Swann. The same permutation as before, where all the quantity are replaced by extended quantity. In the sector with Gauss number zero, well, reproduce the previous parametrization. In the sector with Gauss number one, one obtain the supersymmetric transformation, the BNS transformation of field, superfield and superform, and they are exactly what one expects, so I don't reproduce them. We are interested instead in the sector with Gauss number two, because that the sector provides the Bianchi transformation, the Gauss and the Gauss constraints. Indeed, what? Okay. Indeed, from the torsion tilde A, since relative Gauss lambda A is zero, we have now we can say, in the previous transparency, I have marked in blue all the terms which are quadratic in the spinor-Lagrange band. The reason is that this term provides the contribution in the sector with Gauss number two. And in fact, these are the results. For the torsion TA, since lambda equals zero, one has zero equal lambda L gamma lambda L plus lambda L gamma lambda R. For the general curvature, since I have assumed that the variation of the relative Gauss vanish, again we have zero equal EA lambda L gamma L lambda L minus lambda L gamma lambda L, so that the two equations, one and two, give exactly the two spinor constraint. Lambda gamma L lambda equal zero, lambda L gamma L lambda L equal zero. For the torsion, spinor-like torsion, we have from this variation of the Gauss lambda is equation 3. Now we can notice that the difference with what happens in the flat background, where the variation of the Gauss vanish, sees the variation that not vanish. Finally, for the other form, G2, G4, and Lorentz curvature extended, we have the other equation, 4, 5, and 6. Here, we can notice, si legge o no? C'è qualcosa, C'è qualcosa che non va? Well, we can notice that the importance of F add the Gauss sigma 0, sigma 2, and psi. Since without this Gauss, we should have a new constraint like lambda L equals 0, and so on. Well, there are, you see, we have obtained the più spinor constraints. Now, as promised, let me show that the technical assumption tilde S, rho 1 equals 0, Rotilde One. Rotilde One vuol dire is very mild and almost automatically satisfied. Indeed, without this assumption, the previous equation is the right hand side is not zero but is equal to a tilde rotilde one, not one, rotilde one. However, for the Bianchi identity, extended dg4 equals h3g2, not gamma 2, another misprint, in the sector equals number 4, we get to the following result. In size lambda L gamma B lambda L plus lambda L gamma B lambda L equals zero, because lambda equals zero, then if you assume that lambda L lambda R is different from zero, we get lambda L gamma lambda L minus lambda L gamma lambda L equals zero, and therefore S tilde or tilde 1 equals zero. This result is quite obvious in a sense, since the equation 8 is nothing else that the first identity in 11 dimensions saturated with 4 lambda. Now we can begin to derive the più spino action. How time?
10 minutes,
okay. Più spino action. Since in the più spino action, the ghost lambda are dynamical quantity, one need also the conjugal momenta of lambda, which are the anti-ghost omega L, omega alpha. And also we need the partner of omega, the supersymmetric partner of omega that I called, that are called D alpha, DL alpha and DL alpha. In terms of lambda and D, the BSR charge is given by the integral lambda alpha D alpha. Moreover, since due to the più spino constraint, lambda L and lambda R have 11 components each, then also omega L and omega R must have 11 physical degrees of freedom. And this is realized by assuming that omega satisfies the gauge symmetry delta omega equal lambda A gamma A lambda, where capital lambda A are local gauge parameters. Given that, the più spino action I has to satisfy two conditions. It must be invariant under the BSR transformation, S equals zero, and must be invariant under the omega transformation, delta omega E, I equals zero. Now, some further remarks. The requirement that Q induce the BLS differential S allow to specify the expression of D alpha. For instance, since the BLS variation of lambda is lambda lambda times X, then one can use that DR and DL have the following expression, where X here is superfield, which is Lorentz valued and Weyl valued in beta and gamma. And the issue which are written here in Lorentz and pure transparency is only the component of each superfield symmetric in beta gamma, or in this case in alpha beta. D zero is a superfield that acting on superfields induce the tangent space derivative d alpha. And moreover, the action of Q over d zero is minus Ea plus minus gamma A times lambda. At that point, one can compute all the variation of Fields and Ghost, in particular also the Yester formation of Omega L, Omega L, DL, DL, which are still unknown. I don't reproduce them, we don't need. Moreover, you can also verify the hypothesis of Q by computing Q squared, which is here, when effectively, when given the form of L and X, one gets zero. It is also instructive to compute the action of Q squared on lambda d and omega. S squared applied to lambda is zero. S squared applied to dl and dl apparently does not this expression, which is, does not seem to be zero. However, if one assumes that the spin-on-like Gell-Bain EL and ER satisfy the field equation, D is equal to zero, D is equal S squared applied to D, is, Q is hypotenuse applied also on D, DR and DL. And then, when we have obtained the più spinor action, we say so that we can prove that by varying this Bayesian action with respect to DL and DL, one obtains exactly this field equation. So this all is consistent. However, S squared of omega does not vanish. In fact, if you compute, one gets S omega L omega L equal E minus plus A gamma A lambda L lambda R. This failure of the hypothesis is a consequence of the omega gate transformation delta omega omega. Indeed, S squared acting on omega vanish only modulo this gate transformation. This is completely consistent, and one can live with this failure of the hypothesis and again derive very well the più spinor action. However, it is also possible to avoid this failure of the hypothesis, the impotence, by fixing the omega gauge, imposing omega r gamma a lambda r equals zero, omega a gamma a lambda r equals zero. This condition, it is convenient to rephrase in another way. Consider the following projector, cap alpha beta, which is given there. In this or this projector, the gauge fixing condition for omega can be expressed as omega L cap equals zero and cap omega L equals zero, or omega R equal omega L 1 minus K and omega L equal 1 minus K omega L. Also, one can verify immediately that cap lambda equals zero and lambda L cap equals zero. And also lambda gamma 1 minus k equals 0 and 1 minus k gamma lambda equals 0. The condition, size 3 kappa equals 5, k is a projector che project on a 5-dimensional superspace of the 16-dimensional Spinorian space, so that omega kappa equals 0 K omega uguale 0, omega L uguale 0, omega K uguale 0, simply show that omega and lambda has 11 components each one. Moreover, projecting this equation 9 with 1 minus K, one gets that S square omega RL equals zero, so that now S is an hypothesis acting on all fields il ghost. Aia. Uffa. Scusa. Torna indietro. Scusa. Sono fuori tempo. Ecco, sono due parole. Tornare indietro di uno. Ho fatto più male o due.
No.
No? Oh, mamma.
No.
Okay.
No.
Scusatemi. Excuse me. Okay. So now you can derive the Pupillar action. The strategy the following in three steps. First step, consider the Gisvas action, EGS, which is here, written here, and its BRS variation, which is written here. Second step, add to EGS a kappa-dependent action, EK, such that EGS plus EK is BRS invariant. Third step, add a gauge fixing term, S integral F, where F is a local functional Gauss number minus one, called the gauge fermion. Since S is now always nilpotent, EGS is automatically BRS invariant. The second step is realized by taking for EK the following expression. I cannot explain why, I have no time, but indeed one can verify that the action of the BRS charge on EGS plus EK is equal to zero. The third step is done by choosing EGF as S times the following expression. By performing the random computation for the total action, one gets the following expression, and this indeed is modulo field definition is just the action first obtained by Berkov-Seehofer. And now, this action is BRS invariant by construction. The fields which appear in this action are completely known, defined in terms of the derivative of Dilaton and so on, and one can show explicitly that the action is invariant under the gauge transformation of omega. And finally, by considering the field equation that follow from this action by varying dl and dr, one gets just the field equation for the Spinola-Gilbane that assure, shown before, the nilpotence of dr in dl. My conclusion is tantissimi auguri.
Or comments? Okay, so
I would like to know about the gauge fixing of the omega. Is there also a natural form for type 2b to gauge fix the anti-ghost omega?
Well, type 2b, now we have, I think yes. I think, I have not explicitly computed. Wait a moment.
Because for the gauge fixing, you were using the different chirality of.
You're right. I understood the question. In the case of, in general, this, what I have described is a so-called Ypsilon formally. And in general, also for instance in the theoretic case, one computer construct the projector K By using, by breaking also the end cap disappear, you constant that by introducing a constant spin of V, okay? So, in the case of 2A, it is not necessary to use a constant spin because lambda L, lambda are opposite chirality. In the case of 2B, if you, I think it is possible to extend this approach to 2B, but if you use this performance, we must use
the constant spin.
We must use, okay? Okay. This is the question was that.
Yes, yes.
Now,
other questions? Okay, so let us thank Mario again. Let us thank Mario. Next speaker is Sergio Ferrara. And he will talk about perturbative and non-perturbative and equal 8 supergravity.
Aspetta che ti mettiamo anche il microfono, che se ci fa un casino fuori.
Intanto questi qua funzionano, vedi? Cioè tu puoi parlare
sì,
qua.
Sì, poi tu hai la voce molto
aspetta
alta.
Aspetta un attimo, aspetta. Si scrive. Comunque, non ti preoccupare. Intanto servito. No, ma funziona questo.
Come fa?
Metto solo questo qui e poi... Allora, per andare avanti... Basta schiacciare questo. Se vuoi andare in, la barra grossa. Se vuoi andare indietro, vedi che qua c'è page up, page down. Scusa, qua. Ecco qua. Vedi?
Ah, quindi avanti, posso usare questi due invece
indietro.
Di questo.
Sì, sì. Ti metto questo.
No.
Ecco. A posto. Ok.
40 minuti.
40 minuti adesso.
Well, yesterday Peter asked me how many papers I wrote with Ricardo, and now I can give an answer. I wrote essentially 70 papers, published papers, with Ricardo, and it's nice that the number 70 comes three times today. 70 is the age that Ricardo... We are celebrating. 70 is a number of paper, and 70 is also the number of scalar fields in N equal 8 supergravity. So the 70 has a threefold meaning today. I started to collaborate with Ricardo in 1975, so it is now 35 years. And in fact, our collaboration was related to construction of algebras in two dimensions having supersymmetry and generalizing the Virasoro algebra. This work was under the influence of the undergoing construction of supergravity with Peter and Daniel Friedman, which was completed in the March 76. Many of my recent papers with Ricardo are on electric magnetic duality and black hole properties, and today I will speak about some research related to this and also some implication of electric magnetic duality, possible implication on the conjecture existence of a finite theory of gravity in four dimensions, as Svibert, Dixon, and others has been emphasizing in recent years. Well, this is the list of papers I wrote with Ricardo. We have, as you see, we have essentially 70 papers with almost 4,000 publications. Some of them are called famous papers. I think that our best papers are not the ones which are called famous papers, but nevertheless, this is the Spire list of records of Ricardo joint paper with myself. Many of our collaborators are affiliated to Polytechnic or to the University of Torino. There are many people here who have been collaborating with Ricardo and myself. My talk today will be on some aspects of extremal black holes in N=8 supergravity and their role in a possible framework of an ultraviolet finite theory. This is a very controversial argument which is under debate. So everything I will say today may be completely wrong or may be right. If it is right, it will be really a revolution because it will question string theory and higher dimensional theories in our way. Today, in the recent days, there has been couple of papers questioning the finiteness, perturbative finiteness of N=8, but I've been reassured by Svi Bern, who has been contacting me, that there are loopholes in all these papers. The paper I'm referring is on a possible seven-loop crisis of a local counterterm which is expected to emerge in N=8 supergravity at semi-loop in the sense that this term is not protected by any non-renormalization theorem. But as we know, non-renormalization theorems are sufficient but not necessary conditions for absence of counterterm, because this counterterm may occur with zero coefficient. And this is in fact what Svi Bern and others are expecting if they are right. I think it's hopeless to think that N=8 supergravity can be finite just because all possible terms are protected by non-renormalization theorem. This is certainly not the case. Well, these are some people who have contributed recently to various aspects of this N=8 finiteness. But what I'm going to say at the end of this talk will be merely related to some work of Green, Oguri, and Schwartz about the relation of N=8 supergravity with some zero slope limit of superstring theory. Actually, in our way, I'm referring to recent work I've done with Massimo Bianchi and Renata Kalos. We are using an approach from four dimension and question the fact that if you live in four dimension, not necessarily open up extra dimension. It depends on which states are going to exist in four dimension, whether or not your theory will open up higher dimension, and then will of course indicate that four dimensional theory is not a complete theory of gravity. In October 76, I was invited by John Schwartz to visit Caltech and to give a seminar on the construction of supergravity. At that time, I was visiting Stony Brook, I was visiting Peter, and we just finished the construction of the supergravity theory with two spin 3/2 particles. That is what is now called N=2 supergravity. When I arrived to Caltech, I was immediately contacted by Murray Gell-Mann, who told me that he was very pleased that we constructed N=2 supergravity. But he told me also that if higher end supergravity would have existed, there was a bound in the number of n, and N=8 would have been the end of the story. This was just a group theoretical argument, but at those days was the first time I heard this fact, because we didn't know anything at that time about even if these theories with more than one gravitino existed or not. Today, after 34 years, we are still struggling with this theory, its connection to superstring and M theory, and its hypothetical perturbative finiteness and its non-perturbative completion. But I think that along all this year, we learn a lot of structures. We know also that these theories, if you are in empty de Sitter space, are related to this famous IDS conformal field theory correspondence, which has a lot of application, as was indicated in previous talks, even connect supergravity to almost experimental physics and plasma physics, heavy ion collision, and so on. There is an interesting aspect about black holes. Black holes have been studied further and further in recent years, especially these black holes which occur in supergravity and string theory. And one of the reasons is because there is a very nice connection between the physics of black hole and the structure of supergravity, like electric-magnetic duality and also the geometrical formula which describe the thermodynamics of black hole, like the area of the horizon which is related to the entropy, or the surface gravity which is related to the extremality parameter. So let me go to discuss N equal 8 black holes, which are black holes in N equal 8 supergravity. Well, first of all, black holes are one of the most stunning consequences of general relativity. The Schwarzschild black hole was essentially found by an accident looking to spherically symmetric solutions of general relativity. And if one try to extrapolate the Coulomb law in general relativity, one find that this extrapolation requires a solution which has a singularity. And this singularity is a famous Schwarzschild singularity, and that solution we know now is describing black holes. There are even more interesting black holes, which in fact naturally occur in supergravity theories, which are charged black holes. Well, black holes can have also angular momentum, but let me describe today only charged black hole. Charged black hole, the simplest one is a Reiser-Nostrum black hole. And these black holes have an interesting phenomenon which doesn't exist in the Schwarzschild case, namely they can be extremal. Extremal black hole have very peculiar properties because they have vanishing temperature in spite of having finite entropy. And if you look at the black hole, and the black hole usually has two horizons, an event horizon and a Cauchy horizon. For an extremal black hole, these two horizons coincide. And the coincidence of this horizon is an indication that for extremal black hole, the surface gravity is zero. And the entropy for this black hole is given by a formula which is a Bekenstein-Hawking formula. This Bekenstein-Hawking formula for an extremal black hole can be always written as an effect in terms of an effective radius of a sphere with an effective horizon radius, which is given here. You have a pointer? Laura, you have a pointer? Pointer. Well, for extremal black hole, for extremal charged black hole, this effective radius actually is a function only of the electric and magnetic charges, which determine the asymptotic quantum number of the black hole. If there are scalar fields around, the scalar field does not appear in the entropy. So the entropy is really only a function of electric and magnetic charges.
And depending on the symmetry of the problem, there are several formulae which give you the entropy. You see that for a Reisner-Nostrom black hole with an electric charge P and a magnetic charge Q, the entropy is just proportional to P squared plus Q squared, and this is just related to the fact that this system has a U1 symmetry, which rotates the P charge into the Q charge. But if you have a more complicated system with scalar field around, then for instance, the Axion-Dillaton black hole is the first example, the entropy, if you have two U1 gauge field and a black hole which has Q1, P1 electric and magnetic charge with respect to a first U1 and P2, Q2 electric magnetic charge with respect to a second U1, then the entropy is related to the combination P1, Q2 minus P2, Q1. And you see immediately that this combination has an SL2 symmetry, has a symplectic symmetry, a non-compact symmetry. Non-compact symmetry of the black hole formula is always related to the fact that there are some scalar fields in the theory, something which is not the case for Reisner-Nostrom. And then these two formulae of the Reisner-Nostrom and Axion-Dillaton black hole generalize to more fancier formulae if you take N equal 4 supergravity. And if you go all the way to N equal 8 supergravity, the formula for the black hole entropy is given by the square root of a quartic E7 invariant, which is called Cartan invariant, because it was found by Cartan studying an exceptional group. And depending how you write it, it has a formula. You can write it or in terms of the Baire charges or in terms of the central charge of your theory, of the N equal 8 theory. I lost here the... Avanti, indietro.
Allora, per andare avanti, questo sarà...
Ok. Okay.
Indietro, quello sotto.
Well, the reason why the scalar, why the entropy for extremal black hole is only depending on charges and not on the asymptotic value of the scalar fields. This is sometimes called a kind of Noether theorem. Is due to a phenomenon which is called the attractor mechanism. And it is an interesting mechanism because essentially it's telling you that in this extremal black hole in supersymmetric theory, scalar trajectories, namely the trajectory the scalar field describe in terms of the evolution parameter of the black hole, which is for a spherically symmetric black hole, is simply the distance of the evolution is in a radial coordinate. Essentially, this mechanism is telling you that under certain conditions on the charges, these scalar fields trajectories behave as dynamical systems. Namely, they describe trajectories which flow always to a fixed point, and this fixed point fixes the value of the scalar field in terms of electric and magnetic charges. And the fixed point precisely corresponds to the horizon. So the value of the scalar field at the horizon is determined in terms of the electric and magnetic charges, and that explains why the entropy is independent of the scalar field, because the scalar fields at the horizon are not just arbitrary numbers, but are fixed by the value of electric and magnetic charges. And this value is actually related to some critical point condition of some potential function. Well, N equal 8 black hole are
what is happening? Che è successo?
Perso il punto.
È soltanto la prima e l'ultima pagina.
No, questo così. Vedi, avanti e indietro. Sì?
Okay. Ok. Now there is another property which actually is crucial, is that this extremal black hole In four dimensions, at the horizon have a universal geometry, namely the geometry at the horizon of the four-dimensional black hole become IDS2 cross S2. This is a particular case of a geometry of black brains in D-dimension. It's a formula which is the four-dimensional version of the formula, in fact, which is used in IDS conformal field theory correspondence to relate gauge theory on the boundary and bulk supergravity. This relation in four dimension is telling you that extremal black hole have a geometry which is the so-called Bertotti-Robinson geometry at the horizon. And also in these theories, the horizon radius, as I was anticipating, is an electromagnetic duality invariant quantity, and in any quality is given by the square root of the quartic invariant of the 56-dimensional representation of E7. Because the charges are 56, because you have 28 vector field, which have 28 electric and 28 magnetic charges, and put together they form the fundamental representation of E6, E7. An electromagnetic duality is essential in this theory and is an E7 rotation. Now the attractor mechanism pictorially is given by this graph. But there is an object which has a more important meaning, and this is the object which is related for supersymmetric black hole is the object which is related, depending whether you compute it at asymptotic infinity of the horizon, it is related to the IDM mass of the black hole or to the entropy of the black hole. And this object for a supersymmetric black hole would be the highest eigenvalue of the central charge. The highest eigenvalue of the central charge for a BPS black hole, if you compute this object at infinity, this is nothing but the IDM mass of the black hole. Now, depending on how many of these central charges are equal, that will indicate what fraction of supersymmetry has the black hole. And in N=8, there are essentially four situations. The black hole can be 1/8 BPS, can be 1/4 BPS, or can be 1/2 BPS, or it can be non-BPS. So there are essentially four situations. When this is non-BPS, this formula is no longer valid, but there is an object which replaces the central charge, and this is what in the supergravity was called the fake superpotential. There is an object which essentially replace the central charge for the case of non-supersymmetric black holes. Now, the interesting property...
Che succede qui? Sei ritornato all'inizio. Allora.
Ma come?
Invito Riccardo. Ecco, qua. Eri qua. Ok.
Sì. The interesting property now is the dependence of this W, which is the central charge or the fake superpotential, as a function of the moduli in a moduli space. And this is essentially the two situations one has. The first situation is the situation where the attractor mechanism is valid. What happens is that this object has an absolute minimum. And the minimum is, in fact, the attractor point. The minimum, this point here, is a point in the scalar field configuration which determines the entropy of the black hole. Or said in another way, this is the point or the value of the scalar field at the horizon. Now, interestingly enough, whether you have this situation or this situation depends on the initial values of the scalar of the electric and magnetic charges. And in fact, it depends what is called the duality orbit of these charges. Depending on which duality orbit the charge is, you have either this situation or this situation. This situation is the case where, in fact, the attractor mechanism is not valid. You see that this object has a runaway behavior. The attractor mechanism is not valid simply because there is a runaway solution for the extremum. The extremum is reached only for phi going to infinity,
or if you want to say in a fancy way, is rich only at the boundary of the moduli space of the theory, but is not rich at the interior of the moduli space. When this happens, actually the classical formula for the Bekenstein-Onking entropy fails, because what happens is that the quartic Cartan invariant for this solution is identically zero, and then the entropy, if you compute it in terms of the quartic invariant, is just zero, which makes the black hole singular, because the black hole becomes zero area. So if the black hole is zero area, the solution is singular, and so this situation here corresponds exactly to a singular solution of general relativity, while this situation here corresponds to a non-singular solution of general relativity. So essentially, let me anticipate the story. The second situation corresponds in the classification of black holes to black holes which have higher supersymmetry. For any equivalent black holes, this is only possible for 1/2 and 1/4 or 1/8 black hole, never possible for non-BPS black hole. Non-BPS black hole are always fall in this category. So strangely enough, less supersymmetry you have, more regular is the black hole in terms of this attractor mechanism. Now, if you remember that the value at infinity, or the value of the scalar, the value of the W computed in terms of the scalar field is the IDM mass, the attractor mechanism can be rephrased in stating that in a regular black hole, the IDM mass is bounded from below in the moduli space. The IDM mass, as a function of the electric charges and the scalar field, has a lower bound, and this lower bound is precisely this gap here. This gap here is measured, in fact, by the quartic invariant of V7 in N equal 8. And you see here that instead there is no gap. And the reason is there is no gap is because the quartic invariant of V7 is zero. So in fact, it is not surprisingly that the gap must be an electric magnetic duality invariant, and the only electric magnetic duality invariant you have in this theory is this quartic invariant of V7. Now, how this analysis is related to the ultraviolet finiteness of gravity, or to, well, it is related in the following sense, that if in a theory you have this situation here is indicating that the black hole can have arbitrary small mass. And if black hole can have arbitrary small mass, you can never neglect these states even in perturbation theory. These states should have a reflection in perturbation theory, because these states will never decouple from the theory, because they can have arbitrary small mass. Another way of saying is that the state having arbitrary small mass, and in fact, there are infinitely of many of these states, because there are infinite values of electric and magnetic charges which can have this quartic invariant equal zero. Accumulation of massless states in this fashion is indicating the opening of an extra dimension. Because when you think about the Kaluza-Klein states, Kaluza-Klein states have, roughly speaking, an object which have a mass which is roughly going in this way in terms of the parameter, radius parameter. For instance, if you go from d plus 1 dimension to d dimension, Kaluza-Klein states have masses which go something like m over r. And m over r behavior is precisely this kind of behavior. And you see that m over r behavior, when r going to infinity, the mass of the Kaluza-Klein state go to zero, and this accumulation of massless states is an indication that you have an extra dimension. This argument was precisely the argument that Witten made in order to relate type 2A string in strong coupling regime to M theory, to a theory in 11 dimension. This is very similar, very similar reasoning to that situation. Well, there is one can make, and this is what we made with Massimo and Renata Gallo, one might make even a more refined analysis. Depending on which fraction of supersymmetry has the singular state, you can really identify this object in higher dimension. If this object is a 1/2 BPS, you can see that the multiplet has in fact higher spin 2. So this is precisely the same multiplet as the Kaluza-Klein graviton. So the 1/2 BPS states are precisely those states which are identical to Kaluza-Klein states in a higher dimension. Well, you can ask the same, if you look instead of this other state which have this behavior, 1/8 and 1/4, what are these states? Well, it's very simple to see that these states, in the case of 1/8 BPS, correspond to regular black hole in higher dimension. And the states which are states which are 1/8 and 1/4, they are multiplet which have a spin higher than 2, so they cannot be Kaluza-Klein state in higher dimension. But you can easily identify them with the black hole in 5 dimension or black strings in 6 dimension with finite area. So this this object corresponds to regular solution in higher dimension. Kaluza-Klein states for 1/2 BPS, black hole for 1/8 BPS, or black string for 1/4 BPS. There is an identification of quantum numbers. But of course, these states, you don't need higher dimension. This is just the relation that you will get if you try to identify these states in the context of higher dimension. So it is clear that a theory which has this kind of states is a strong indication that in a four-dimensional theory has this kind of state. This theory is really not living in four dimensions. This theory is essentially a reduced theory of a higher dimensional theory, and this is what, in fact, string theory is indicating. Well, the way out to this situation, which is that if a four-dimensional theory of gravity, which is a finite theory of gravity, exists, and these states are singular, well, these states should be simply excluded from the spectrum of the theory. So regular, our proposal that the finite theory of n equal a supergravity, the only black hole that makes sense in this theory are the black hole which have IDS2 cross S2 geometry. So these are the black hole which have a finite horizon, and are the black hole for which the IDS conformance theory correspondence, in fact, is valid. And we know, in fact, that for this black holes here, there is even a quantum theory associated to it. Because if we use IDS conformance theory correspondence, this kind of black holes correspond to some quantum mechanical system on the boundary of IDS2. So there is really a quantum description of this kind of black holes in four dimensions. There is no such a description for this black holes here. But this is okay, because if this black hole exists, we know that the four-dimensional theory cannot be the end of the story. So the question is whether it is correct to keep only the states and to disregard the states. Well, we don't see any reason why this is not correct. In four dimension, there is no reason why singular state should be retained. If this singular state are retained, then the option of higher dimension and the completion of n equal a supergravity in string theory on a higher dimensional theory is then justified. So it is quite important that there is a way somehow of connecting dependence of the masses in moduli space with this attractor mechanism. This is a kind of infrared ultraviolet connection, because it gives a relation between the value of this function at infinity with the value of the function at the horizon. The horizon, in some sense, is the ultraviolet, and the infinity is the infrared, and the infinity is the ultraviolet. The reason why there is this connection is because, as I said, the attractor mechanism is telling you that black holes which have IDS2 cross S2 geometry have a mass gap, so they can never become massless. So a theory which has only IDS2 crosses 2 black hole with IDS2 crosses 2 geometry will never see higher dimensions. It will never see because there are no such states which go to zero mass in some point of the moduli space. And of course, an interesting reflection of this is that these black holes are precisely those black holes which have a quantum mechanical interpretation already in 4 dimensions because of the IDS2 crosses 2, because of the IDS conformal field theory correspondence applied to this particular case, to this 4-dimensional, to this 4-dimensional case. Well, we have seen also that these singular states have always dove?
No, questi due sotto, questi due. No, non deve andare. Qua uno e quell'altro okay. Sotto. Ok.
We have also seen that all four-dimensional singular black hole have a higher dimensional interpretation. The fraction of supersymmetry is telling you essentially which object you have in higher dimension. And one half are Kaluza-Klein state, and less than one half they are essentially regular brains in higher dimension. Well, if Zwi-Bern analysis turn out to be correct, there is another, and this is the last point of the puzzle of this argument. Another property that has n equal a supergravity, which was proven long ago by Marcus, is that n equal a supergravity has no sigma model anomalies. Sigma model anomalies have to do here with the E7 and SU8 symmetry being valid in perturbation theory or not. Well, sigma model anomalies in this case has to do with the law that in n equal a supergravity, E7 continuous symmetry is not broken in perturbation theory, while certainly E7 continuous symmetry is broken by the presence of black holes, because black holes require charge quantization, and so the E7 continuous symmetry should be replaced by some discrete version of E7, exactly like in the case of SL2Z in type 2B string theory, SL2R. The continuous SL2R of type 2B supergravity is broken to SL2Z for existence by the existence of PQ strings. PQ strings in type 2B require quantization of charges, and that break SL2R to SL2Z. For black hole, we would expect E7 are broken to 7Z. Now, what is strange is that while in a type 2B string, you can see the breaking of SL2R already in perturbation theory from the dependence of the dilaton of string amplitudes, in four-dimensional supergravity, at least to the order of loops for which finite has been proven, there is no indication that E7 symmetry, continuous E7 symmetry is broken. Continuous E7 symmetry implies some low energy theorems, because essentially here, this theory is a sigma model, and the sigma model, scalar field sigma model, have some low energy, satisfy some low energy theorem, which have to do with the with the vanishing of the amplitude when momenta related to scalar field go to zero in the amplitude, and these low energy theorems are in fact not broken in this perturbative supergravity. On the other hand, Dixon and Dixon proved recently that if an R to the 4 counter term would have been generated in a 4 graviton amplitude, that counter term would have not broken supersymmetry, but would have break E7 continuous symmetry. So it looks really that the result of Bern et al. Are an indication that in perturbation theory E7 continuous symmetry is not broken. So if E7 continuous symmetry is not broken, this looks again an indication that non-perturbative state with arbitrary small mass should not be present in this theory. While if the states have a mass gap, which is of the order of the Planck mass, that is an indication that this continuous symmetry, that you don't see the effect of these non-perturbative states to any finite order of perturbation theory. But of course, we don't know whether this perturbative supergravity is going to be finite or not, so we don't know whether this hypothesis is correct. But in some sense, the result of B-Bern indicate that there is no remnant of broken E7 symmetry in a finite order of perturbation theory in any equal A supergravity, and that is something which makes a big difference from any equal A supergravity to string theory in 10 dimension, where in fact higher loops introduce already terms which are a tail of some modular functions of the dilaton parameter, and these modular functions are a reflection of the breaking of SL to R to SL to Z. So I think in this seminar I tried to make an interrelation between aspects of general relativity of black hole physics and of some aspect of recent research in this debatable subject of ultraviolet finiteness of n equal a supergravity. This is a very interesting aspect, because even if n equal a supergravity is not doesn't seem to be close to physics, if n equal a supergravity as a four-dimensional theory is going to be finite, certainly it must have something to do with physics. We know already that there is an example, which is n equal 4 Jahn-Mills theory is a very bad theory if you try to apply to particle physics, but in fact, because of the IDS conformality field theory correspondence, n equal 4 Jahn-Mills theory is in fact a field theory which has a lot of physical application. And if n equal a supergravity turns out to have a similar story, probably there will be same kind of forthcoming application of this theory to some variety of physical problems. Thank you very much.
I'm sympathetic to excluding the singular solutions. My question is, you can regard the 1 over 8 BPS black hole as a bound state of 4 1/2 BPS black holes. So does this mean there's some confinement mechanism that prevents it from decaying into its constituents?
Well, you know, in some sense, quarks are also abstract entities which do not exist as a physical particles, so it may be that 1/2 BPS states are like quarks. It is what you are saying.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
So in some sense, the fact that they are singular doesn't matter, because they do not correspond to particles.
But does E7 prevent the decay? Is there some reason for why they
can't? Well, that's in string theory, certainly you can have this this decay, because in string theory these solutions are all regular. None of these solutions is singular. So, but in supergravity, whether you have this decay or not depends whether these particles are in the spectrum. That is like to say, if you have QCD, is there any particle which has the same quantum number of a two-quark system, some stable object, or I mean, we don't know the spectrum of this theory.
In a confinement mechanism.
Well, you know, this is something which I learned from Linde. So it's general relativity. You know, it's very Every argument you make here is hand waving because you combine general relativity argument with particle physics argument, and this argument not always go in a very simple way together. But my understanding is that there is a kind of weak censorship hypothesis. This is what something that I learned from Linde, which tells you that in general relativity, regular geometries can never evolve to singular geometries. If you have regular geometries somehow make a self-consistent subset of geometries. So if you're using some sense of this kind of weak censorship hypothesis, this weak censorship hypothesis should be what you call confinement in this kind of theories in some sense. That the a consistent quantum theory of gravity should not produce singular geometries from regular geometries. If this is the case, then this would be an answer to your question. So maybe that what confinement is in general relativity is this weak censorship hypothesis, but that I think is just, I don't know if you ever heard about this argument. Yeah, okay, that is the argument.
More questions? Okay. So we are going to have a break. We'll be back at 5 to 12.
Yes. Maybe later you can tell me. Are you here tonight?
Yeah, we are going the same.
After the meeting, you can tell me that.
But this is, you don't know this paper by Marcus?
No.
This paper went unnoticed, but it's something similar.
Era giusto per provare e poi...
Sì. Adesso faccio un attimo una prova, poi ci prendiamo, eh? Soluzione, non so se la devi impostare, è 1024x768.
Adesso.
Hertz. La puoi leggere qua, eh?
Ah, non l'ho visto.
Qua, a destra vede quello che viene proiettato.
Ok. Sì, sì, perfetto.
Ok.
Adesso stacco però perché ci sarà.
Sì, tanto basta poi solo attaccare, poi fa un cenno, fa un cenno, io comunque sono lì, guardo, faccio il cambio da sorgente.
D'accordo.
E invece il prossimo è proiettato.
Le do invece
proiettare qua.
Sì.
Thank you.